playtesters were pretty annoyed when we started making their expertise of the game less valuable by helping newbies. So you can't always just listen to the playtesters straight up. You have to kind of filter that through. This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us, as always, is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment. Later, Activision is now CTO of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
And this time, we also welcome Malin Sundberg. Malin is a software developer, podcaster, and recently worked on the newly released mobile strategy game, Two Spies. Hi, Malin.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
It is good to be back. It's been a long time. It's been 3.5 years since we had an Up, Up, Down, Down episode.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been slightly less than that since we recorded an Up, Up, Down, Down episode. Because if I remember correctly, we did record one that we didn't release.
Yes.
Because your daughter was born.
Yeah, and then my daughter was born 6 weeks early.
Oh.
Coincidentally, 3.5 years is the exact age of my daughter, how long the show has been on hiatus. And, you know, all the editing and organizing guests and topics is a lot when you have a newborn, a young kid in the house.
Yeah.
But I thought it was a good occasion to have a very special episode of Up, Up, Down, Down because we made a game.
Yeah, that's very exciting.
Yeah, which is, I thought, like we had this podcast about making games, talking to people who made games.
Yeah, it fits perfect.
And then, you know, we went and like actually made one. So it seemed like a good opportunity to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
And Malin seemed like a great person to talk to us about it and play a little bit of interview to kind of prompt some of the questions. And also Malin helped us ship the game as it was coming into the home stretch. So she's familiar with it.
Yeah.
Enough that the figure might be a good person to be able to expound a little bit on some of the stuff when we are in the weeds of the stuff that we actually were working on for all this time.
I'm looking forward to chatting about this. It was also fun because I tested this. I looked up my test flight invite and I was starting to test the game in 2018 in December. So it's great to see it being shipped now. But I looked back and I just remember the logo being completely different. So I think it's been through so many iterations. So I think it's exciting to talk a bit about that.
It has been through a lot of iterations.
It is a highly iterated game. I mean, iteration obviously is a huge part of getting anything to be good. You first make a bad version and then you make a less bad version and eventually get to hopefully a good version or at least a better than it was version. But in the case of this one, the original prototype of the game was actually 5 years ago. The experiment was Alan, I was thinking, I'd like to learn Swift, which if you're an iOS developer or up in the world of programming language, you will know that that language has been out for a long time now.
So did you start already before Swift 1? Did you start when it was still in beta, or which iteration were we on then?
Well, we started in November. So by then, I think
then it would have been 1.0.
Swift 1.0 or maybe Swift 1.1 when they sort of settled down a little bit. There's a couple pretty fundamental things about it that changed in the first couple months.
Yeah, feels like you went through a lot of... It's not the easiest language to pick, I think, considering how much it was iterated on by itself. So I think iterating on a game with a language that is still being iterated on would have been quite a fun challenge.
I would say in some ways, though, we weren't hurt as badly by that as some app projects were, because a lot of the really brutal changes in Swift 3 particularly, which was like the release that has the worst reputation as a Swift release, were all about changes to the way you interact with Apple frameworks, which obviously there's some of that. Like it's, you know, it is a iOS specific game. It's not like a standard, you know, game, multi-platform game where you've got a core written in some language and you're doing, you know, rendering an OpenGL or whatever, and then there's a very thin wrap around it. It is actually an iOS game through and through, but you know, maybe only about like half the code directly interacts with the Apple frameworks. And there was even less of that in the early versions of the game, right? The first versions of the game were very much just the map. And so,
yeah. So what did I don't think I actually seen what the original game looked like. How was the, like, what stage of the prototype? How much prototyped was it, and how much was working? And like, can you tell me about the state?
Yeah. So, and I'll also, for those following at home who haven't seen the incessant tweeting and other messaging I've been doing about it, what even is the game? So the original idea was I wanted to learn Swift, and I've prototyped games on and off and built games hobby-wise and side project-wise since I was in high school. And so I wanted to do a turn-based spy strategy game. And so that's where Two Spies came from. And the original prototype was a screen with little UI labels like that you just drag and drop from Interface Builder, spread out across the, not even storyboard, just like an Interface Builder file, mm-hmm. For full screen, and then just put little cities in Europe that were, you know, Budapest and Rome and London and Moscow and all the cool sort of interesting places that a Cold War spy might go, and drop them and just like hand edited all of the labels and then hook those all up to the storyboard or to the Interface Builder outlets, and then had three buttons that were strike, control, and pass. And then if you tapped one of the cities, it would travel there. Okay. And then if you did one of the other three actions, then kind of implemented this little game mechanic, basically, where you could sort of control parts of the map. And if you could deduce where the other person was, and then it had the simple multi-peer connectivity Bluetooth mm-hmm. networking library that I think had been just released fairly recently at that time.
Pretty sure the first version was just Game Center.
I think it was Bluetooth first. I don't remember for sure whether or not it was multi-peer connectivity. I think it was originally multi-peer connectivity, and then we moved to Game Center. What do they call the asynchronous game type, where you send and the other person could take as long as they want to send a turn back? And then we changed to Game Center real time, and then we changed to the entire story of the networking, of the different networking approaches we took for the game is like its entire other rat hole. But I think the first version was just Bluetooth, because I remember us playing in the basement of a bar that didn't have Wi-Fi, okay. or at least not very good Wi-Fi. I was able to get the prototype loaded up on a couple devices at the Alibi Room here in Vancouver, and get the prototype within a week of starting it, and just working on it in the evenings and weekends, and put it in front of a couple people, and people seemed to really like it. They were having a lot of fun. Obviously, things are a little bit extra fun over drinks, but people were pretty excited about it, and they were like already asking the number one question that we get still today. They were asking that down in that bar 5 years ago. When is there going to be an Android version?
It sounds like it was really different. So you only had three actions?
Yeah, so now over the kind of iterations of the game has taken as a side project, to be clear, not that we've worked on it like full time for 5 years straight. It's like work on a little bit as a side project, work on some other stuff. We've shipped multiple other like of our own products, as well as like, I don't know, probably 50 apps for clients, I would say, maybe in that amount of time. But the three core actions are still the same ones that they are now, which is the ability to control a city, the ability to strike if you think the other player is in the same city as you, and the ability to pass. But then since then, we've added maybe about half a dozen other actions. And most of the things that were added since then were made to resolve an issue that came up during playtesting. Like Nigel probably remembers the early like first few weeks when I was like really excited about it, and I would make some gameplay tweak, and we'd be getting ready to work in the morning. I'd be like, okay, but quick first, let's play test this, like see how it feels.
That's great. I always enjoy being at that stage of a product when you're so excited to get tested on it or just show someone. That's always a good indication, I think, for a fun project.
Yeah, working on games is fun too. Yeah. So it's kind of this inherent and quick loop when you have this very simple prototype and you can, you know, change it within 10 minutes. And there were some pretty fundamental game mechanics that we changed about how many, like for a long time, the game now, you get two actions per turn and you can either move and move or act and move or move and act or act and act. But for a long time, you actually could only do one of each. You had one travel and one action per. term.
Oh, okay. So it was very sort of directly enforcing a certain gameplay pattern.
Yeah, and that was just kind of out of, it didn't occur to us that the game would be like that, you could, that it could work if you let them pick either order. Mm-hmm. And do you remember, Nigel, whether or not it insisted whether or not you act first and then move, or move first and then act? Or is that something that...
I'm pretty sure you could do them in either order. That was always kind of like the one of the fundamental strategic decisions you had to make in that era. And I think it's still fairly relevant today, is, are you being more aggressive and moving first and then acting, but, you know, risking that you're going to be more visible if you act second, or are you acting and then moving, right? So always that decision you kind of had to make on the first turn was, okay, am I going to move to another city and control it, or am I going to move to that city and not do anything? And then the next turn, I'll control first and then move. So they, you know, I've lost mm-hmm. half a turn, but they don't know where I am.
Yeah, and that's the kind of like gameplay. I mean, all game design, whether or not you're doing it intentionally or not, is the practice of attempting to give players interesting decisions to make.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
The more interesting the decisions that they're making, or the more decisions they can make that are interesting, that, you know, without overwhelming people. And that's kind of like the craft of making games. And so a lot of the tweaks that we made since then was providing additional interesting options, like different abilities to without overwhelming people, but giving them other interesting things they could do instead. And then often adding abilities or changing abilities to prevent what someone found as an abusive strategy. Like early on, one of the things was just control three cities in the corner of the map. Like, people control like Moscow, Warsaw, and like, you know, some Iron Curtain cities, mm-hmm. and then just hide in Moscow and then just sit there and wait for like someone to try to attack them, and mm-hmm. then mm-hmm. basically lash out and kill them. Like, that's was the first broken strategy, but way back when.
So how did you stop that strategy from happening? Was that when you started locking down cities in the end?
We actually, that was the origin of the ability Deep Cover. And we added a new ability which allowed you to go into, so if you're in cover, that's when the other opponent doesn't know where you are, mm-hmm. which you spend most of the game trying to be in that state. But then there was an ability Deep Cover that allowed you for one turn to sneak into an enemy city without them knowing, basically. And so then once you had that, then you could sort of bust a turtle. Like, if someone is just boringly turtling and hiding mm-hmm. in a corner, yeah. you could use Deep Cover to sneak into the city. And then when it was your turn, you could steal that city and then step back out. And so it was like very specifically a mechanism in the way that if you play like a game like chess, that's quite elegant. But then you see like there's a couple things that are kind of seem like arbitrary rules on top of a fairly elegant game. Mm-hmm. Those are often like, oh, okay, this game is pretty good, but there's this one problem. And okay. so they try to fix those.
Okay. Yeah. I think I have seen some people, when I'm playing with people, I see some people who are just like staying silent for a real long time and sort of staying in cities that aren't occupied. But then I think there are some other abilities, like you can get an ability so that you're revealing the other player as soon as you enter the city that they're in. Is that sort of how that ability came about as well?
Yes, definitely. So that ability is called Rapid Recon.
Yes.
So basically makes it so that you can explore around, and if you stumble across the city that the enemy is hiding in, it'll reveal them. And that's like a later game ability, but it's very specifically coming out of doing playtesting, or like, this is an interesting game, you can totally have fun with it, but it's too viable to just hide and mm-hmm. do nothing, which is been a huge, a lot of that iteration and going back to the, not drawing board, but be feeling, this game isn't quite working because of this problem or that problem. Often the problem was, in theory, it's a game about sneaking around, but if you sneak too much, it's not fun because the other person doesn't know where they are, doesn't know where you are, and therefore can't do anything, and therefore it's not interesting for the other person, as opposed to most of the games when we think about sneaking games are like a game like Deus Ex or the Assassin's Creed, where if you are fully successfully sneaking all the time, then there's no other player to be frustrated. Like, imagine being the guards in Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
It would be horrible.
Yeah, multiplayer Assassin's Creed, where one player played the assassin and the other player played the guard, would not be a very interesting game.
But we had a bunch of the problems that you have, if you think of like multiplayer Assassin's Creed, we have a bunch of the problems that sort of come up from trying to do that, because in this mechanism where you're sneaking around and when you find the other person, then you take them out and win the round, or if you successfully guess where they are, that made it intense and fun and sort of satisfying to win. But it also meant that if you made any mistake that was like an error of like, oh, you tapped the wrong city, mm-hmm. or you didn't mean to do that and you did it anyway, then you could just die in one hit. In the same way Assassin's Creed, you can just like, oh yeah, you can just take a guard out because you're this super spy that has snuck up on them. Mm-hmm. And so a huge amount of the iteration was in doing usability tests, watching someone play, seeing the frustrations with one interface style or another, and then trying to make it answer the question, how can we make it so that they can quickly, on a phone interface, how can they quickly and satisfyingly take an action in mm-hmm. a way that we're 100% sure that's the action they actually wanted to take?
I think another big part of that is the sort of rule that we came out with fairly early on in development and then explored all the consequences of it, of trying to have there not being any hidden information, like that you weren't making decisions necessarily based on like your memory of things or like things that had happened that you aren't sure what state things are in. Like it, definitely within the last 2 years or so of development, we added a lot of things that were all informational, right? About making sure that the player always had all the information available mm-hmm. that they needed to make reasonable decisions, rather than it being like, oh, I moved into that city because I thought it was safe, but it turns out it wasn't safe, and that's where they were.
Yeah.
And I think that also feeds into that, trying to put the player in a situation where they're not going to have as many head smack moments as they could of like, oh, I didn't think of that crap.
Yeah, yeah. So I think one example, would that be the, I think the could be here indicator flag. That is something Absolutely. That was added quite recently, right?
Yeah, that came out of basically, in the early game, you would get, when the opponent did certain things, in particular control a city or tried to strike you, it would reveal them, mm-hmm. and or if they went into your territory. But then there were certain other circumstances where you could figure out then, because you knew that they were revealed 2 turns ago, and you know what cities you can travel to from what other cities, you could always deduce, okay, where could they be mm-hmm. and where mm-hmm. couldn't they be? Mm-hmm. And in the kind of middle development of the game, like early on, the game was very sort of just finding itself and finding the fun. And then once we'd found the fun, and you know, a few of us were pretty good at it, a lot of the time we spent was in mentally calculating where could they be and where couldn't they be. And then we would take an action and then we would maybe die because we did something that we thought was safe, or we'd do something kind of risky, but we hadn't considered one aspect. And so as you played against players who were better and better, and as the game got a little bit more complicated, you would have to spend more and more mental energy being like, well, actually, it seems like they could be in this city, but because an intel pickup spawned on the map on that city, and I know the intel doesn't spawn in cities where an enemy is hiding, then I know that they couldn't be there, or that happened last turn, so they couldn't have traveled from there last turn. Like, it gets very complicated, and initially that, like, it's kind of interesting to do that, but you get tired of that mental gymnastics really quickly, and the more fun thing is trying to outwit your friend and trick them into thinking you're in Geneva is the actually fun part.
No, I agree. I think I really enjoy being able to like consider all the other person's options. But like you say, that could be quite exhausting. So I think if you want to have this more like meta game where people sit in the same room and might like try to like say something to trick the other person, I think that's something that would be really hard to do if people have to be so focused on all the different scenarios that could have played out. So I think it just makes it a bit more relaxing to play, I think, if you have a little bit more of a visual indication.
It also makes the game way more accessible for people that are just starting out, because you know, those of us who are working on the development of the game or like our very early play testers, we're getting pretty good at figuring most of that stuff out. It would be frustrating for us because a lot of times we lose the game because of making mistakes in that, which was not fun. But for someone new coming into the game, they just had no ability to even put that all together. So it created a real gulf between experienced players and new players, which is something that we really wanted to avoid, because our sense from fairly early on in development, like I would say maybe even within the first year, is that the most fun way to play this is like in the same room with someone you know, right? That the way that's enjoyable is, you know, you say to a friend like, hey, I've got this cool game I like playing, you know, download it on your phone, let's have a game of it, right? Mm. And if the way that the game gets spread is by experienced people inviting noobs to play the game with them, it's very difficult to have that be fun unless there's a reasonable leveling of things going on. And a lot of that information it's kind of like, it's really public information. Like if you had perfect memory, you could work it all out. But so much of how good you were at the game depended on how good you were at remembering all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It just kind of blew that relationship apart. And so, yeah, like I said, we spent a lot of time figuring out, like, how can we make sure that everything that you could figure out about the game is represented in some way that, you know, that with a little bit of training, people can know how to understand what the meaning of it is.
And that's why, like, probably 80% of the complexity of the game is, like, the map rendering theory. Like, you know, we had this simple map that at one point was just UI labels, mm-hmm. that just you could tap and they would travel you there, and they would have a little emoji basically for enemy was revealed here or not, whereas now there's a whole bunch of that state, and it's almost all, not very much because of new functionality, but because of what Nigel's talking about, of helping clearly indicate, okay, they were revealed here and they are still here, or they were revealed here but they've since moved, or they could be here or they couldn't be here, or, you know, helping clarify, oh, they've controlled this area, it's safe to go here, it's not safe to go here, and helping bring people who are new to the game up to the point where they can actually have fun against somebody who's already played a lot faster than the early days where you just throw them a meat grinder basically, and then the experienced players would just obliterate new players 100% of the time and it was never any fun.
I think that makes sense. I think, like you say, there's been a lot of work going into just making sure that, like, the state is really represented on the map. And I think you're right. I think it does help. It does help new players. And I think it makes it a bit more social. I feel like what I really like about the game is that, which is something I really liked from the very start, is that it's sort of like you can play it like a board game, but it would never work as a physical board game.
Yeah, one of the App Store commenters was talking about that. I think actually it might have been on Twitter someone else was talking about that. About that it is very much, and it was kind of designed to look like a board game and kind of feel like a board game, but the game mechanics wouldn't actually work in real life because it would be way too hard to keep track of everything.
Yeah.
The computer helps you a lot to enable a type of sneaky gameplay with a bunch of, you know, hidden information. Like we have this idea of no hidden information in terms of, like, don't make you memorize what the previous actions were. But we have obviously the hidden information of where your opponent is, and it's much more able, it's much more possible to do that with a game like this that's digital. But then it still has kind of the fun of just being a board game. It's like a little less intimidating that just sort of looks like a map of Europe with links in between the cities.
Though there are board games that do have hidden information, like in this style, like one that I played quite a bit of, and I think I maybe made Alan play one or two games of just to show it to him when we were in early development, is there's a game called Scotland Yard that's all about this same kind of, like, tracking a person with an unknown location on the map. So it's an asymmetrical game, not a symmetrical game like Spies is, where you've got one player who's a criminal and then you've got 2 to 5 players, I think, who are police officers that are, like, tracking him across London. And there's, on most turns of the game, you don't know where the criminal is. Like, the criminal's writing down their moves in secret. You get some information, like what transportation modes they use, and then they're revealed every couple of turns. But I mean, it does have some of the same problem, definitely, that Spies does in the physical board game, of the issue of not always being able to really track all of the options, right? Like, I've played plenty of games of Scotland Yard where the criminal was able to slip through the net because the detectives were just like, okay, well, you know, he used an underground and then two taxis and a bus. Mm-hmm. And so here's all this locations that he could be, but
they made it off by one error in calculating.
Actually, there's one. Yeah, there's one route that you missed. And so actually he could have taken this other location here and you just didn't see it. And it's just as frustrating in Scotland Yard as it was in Spies before, you know, us kind of trying to encode as much of that information in the map as possible.
And that was definitely an example of, like, we did a lot of playtesting, especially in that first user experience. But mm-hmm. playtesters were pretty annoyed when we started making their expertise of the game less valuable by helping newbies. So you can't always just listen to the playtester straight up. You have to kind of filter that through.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Have you at all considered to have like a hardcore mode where you turn off all of the sort of all of the like map niceties, like all of the helper functions, and like remove all of the could be here flags and everything like that?
Yeah, that was definitely a bunch of people suggested that early on. When we added them, there were people like, oh yeah, you should have a version where you're taking them back off. Mm. I haven't done that in a long time. I like prototyped it, but it would be easy to build. And so it's one of those, you know, to give the game more longevity of people trying, it might be worth trying that. My instinct though is that it's not as fun to be spend your time and effort doing arithmetic than it is to spend your time and effort thinking about strategies. And that was something we did specifically, like from the beginning, we wanted it to be a strategy game. Mm-hmm. How do we let you spend your time making the interesting decisions of what strategy do I want to use? How do I want to try and fake out the other person as opposed to, you know, I mean, arithmetic is fun to some people, like that's part of a bunch of puzzle mechanics, but... Mm-hmm. One of the things that came out of all that playtesting was the dossier interface, which I know that, Malin, mm-hmm. early on you had a bunch of feedback on, and you were one of the many playtesters that was like, are you sure you want to have this interface where so for people who haven't seen it or haven't tried the game yet, mm-hmm. when you want to take an action, instead of just being a button that says control this city, you grab what we call a dossier is basically like a card at the bottom of the screen and drag it up into the map and let go that takes that action. Comes from not wanting to risk somebody just tapping a single button and taking an action it ruining the game basically. Mm-hmm. But that, like when we got to the point where we were having a conversation about, oh, why does it work this way? And are we sure we want to do it that way? We had already gone through a whole bunch of iterations. Like there was the initial prototype where you just tapped and it was way too error prone. And then there's a prototype where you would tap and you would confirm every single time. Like basically, are you sure you want to strike your opponent in Geneva? Yes or no. Every time, and it made the game feel way more tedious to have this like, every single thing you do, you're like, do this, yes, do this, confirm, do this, confirm. Mm-hmm. And so we eventually got to, I mean, for traveling around the map, there's the obvious thing. No one complains about that you drag your person and then let go to confirm that that's where you want to move. But when you drag an action and then drop it to confirm, and it's a little bit, it's an unusual game mechanic in terms of like UI. So that was still one of the things we spent a lot of time just experimenting with and being like, are we sure we want this? But you know, I think we definitely got from the point where like 90% of playtesters complained about it based on the way we had all of the animations and mechanics down to very few, like maybe 5%. Yeah. And even then people normally, when they do complain, it's the only way we see it is if we do a usability test and we're like watching what they say or out loud, they might be like, oh, that's weird. But then within 5 or 10 seconds, they tend to get it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it feels, I'm playing around with it right now. It just feels like a lot smoother now, the way you drag up the dossier. I felt like before we started making this change, I think it was difficult to know, like, to differentiate how a dossier works from a physical card, because I think the fact that it looks a bit like a card made it seem a bit unnatural. But I think now it's more like dragging up an action and you get this sort of confirmation for the action before, because you have this zoom in, and I feel like it works. It works really well. I feel like it feels pretty smooth now, and it matches with the action as well. So I think the fact that those go hand in hand makes it feel like a very nicely themed mechanic. I think it's nice that those fit well together.
To get there, though, it's something that I take for granted now because I've seen it so many times and we've built it over time. But there's probably, there's at least half a dozen little micro interactions that make that work. So you have the dossier sitting there at the bottom that describes just its name, let's say the control. And then when you tap it, it reveals the details of what that will do in themed as like a little mission dossier, you know, with a little spiced kind of accoutrement around it. And it describes what will happen and what the consequences will be. And when that appears, it has a vertical animation that's quite subtle, but it kind of appears and then it kind of shifts up a little bit to hint, hey, I want to go up. And then if you drag your thumb once it's up, then it will go up and down, but it won't go left and right, which is another kind of hint that it wants to be dragged up. And then when you drag it far enough up into the map, this is the more recent change you're talking about, the card disappears and then a spotlight zooms in on the location where it's going to take effect. And your character kind of like bounces a little bit, is like a, hey, when you let go, this action is going to happen on me. And the rest of the screen is kind of darkened. And it also highlights the little action lightning bolt that you're going to spend when you let go. And it also strokes the dossier color of the one that you're going to, because once it hides the card to prevent the confusion you're talking about, then it is no longer as clear what action you're going to take. Mm-hmm. So it also does like a player colored stroke around the dossier.
Yeah.
And then when you let go, it actually takes the action. So that's like, I don't know, 8 or 10 separate UI polishes that we added over in response to playtesting. Oh, to fix this confusion, to fix this confusion, to fix this confusion, to like, and most of them were not 100% of people, but sometimes as high as like 40% of people would not catch this subtlety of the action.
Yeah. No, I think considering how, like now when you say how many different UI tweaks were made, I feel like it still feel like one action. It doesn't feel like there are all those different components changing. It feels pretty fluid, I think. But I think it's definitely taken a lot of time to get there. And I think in the beginning when I started with it, I was sort of wondering, oh, why don't you use buttons or why don't you use this? And then, yeah, we've been talking a lot before the recording about that. There were so many iterations for that. And I think, like for me, like one of the idea was that when I first started playing it, I thought it was a card. And I think this new animation sort of gets rid of that mental model of it actually being a playing card. It's more like an action confirmation. I feel like that makes sense as an action now. It feels less.
Yeah, and that to me is the success of, like, that means we're doing it right if it feels coherent and doesn't, like, when you use it, you're like, oh man, 12 different iterations must have gone to finally get to this huge complicated thing, then that's a problem, right? Then you're sort of making people suffer for your UI being confusing with a little pop-up saying like, please click here, and like little handwritten, like, this is when you want to take an action, this is what's going to happen, with an animation and writing and a voiceover and stuff like that. And we tried pretty hard until pretty late in the sequence to not just hit people over the head with stuff. And then just in the last couple months, when we finally picked our ship date and we said, all right, we're shipping the week of December 8th and we're going to ship it then. And that's what it's going to be. And then when we would do usability tests and someone didn't understand something and we just had tried 3 different ways of fixing it, we're like, well, there's going to be a pop-up that explains it and you have to press okay. And we did that and it worked. Not for the drag dossiers, but like a couple other little details, like how cover works. We tried maybe 10 iterations and people understood more and more and more, but it was just, there's that last 10 or 20% of people that weren't clicking with it. And we had kind of tried to make a stand against tutorial pop-ups that you modally have to agree, yes, I understand how this works. But eventually we gave in, and that's maybe the right trade-off of, you know, eventually you have to ship, but once you've taken the low-hanging fruit of, can we make these things explain themselves? Yes, 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 no, yes, yes, no.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important to try to iterate and like see an idea through, but then like in the tutorial scenario, I feel like, I think that's what you're referring to. I think that sometimes it's good to maybe handhold the user a bit more, especially in the beginning. But I think for an action that you do so frequently, like pulling up an action, I think having a button there to always have to confirm, that would be quite a tedious motion. So I think it makes sense that this was something that was going through so many iterations.
There's so many little things like that where we would do usability test and the person who was learning the game would make a suggestion how to fix the confusion that would fix their confusion, but then make the game worse forever. Right? It would make it a little bit more annoying for the action that you do thousands and thousands of times in return for it making more sense the first time. And we made a couple of those trade-offs, but we fought fairly hard to try and come up with a solution. Well, can we help you learn this instead of like off? Or sometimes it would be like, well, just don't let me do that. Like, just say error, you can't do that. And there's a couple of things where we did that. But most of the time, if you say error, you can't do that because the user wouldn't want to do that, there is an advanced or a pro user who would want to do that thing in order to throw the other person off guard.
In some ways, the tutorial itself is kind of us finally giving up on being completely self-teaching that way, though. Of, you know, we did for a long time kind of have this like, okay, we've got to make sure that everything is extremely clear and that people can figure everything else out from the game. And then eventually at some point we're just like, okay, well, actually, we probably just have to have some tutorial steps where we just tell the users do this and then do this and this will happen and explain kind of the fundamental concepts to them. And I mean, that's a, you know, that's an incredibly hard problem in game development in general, how to like smoothly introduce players to game mechanics. Mm-hmm. And I'm not super satisfied with like our final approach to that. Like, I think if we'd started on the tutorial earlier rather than leaving it to be one of the last things to get done, like, we probably could have done better than we ended up doing. But at the same time, then the tutorial would have had to be iterated along with the rest of the gameplay, and everything would have just taken more effort to do.
I think the games that have the most successful tutorials to me are the ones that have the luxury of being a single player game that they control the pace, and so they can say, okay, well, we're going to give you something simple to do. Oh, now you picked up a weapon. You can use that. Oh, now you picked up a weapon with more functionality. Oh, now we've presented you with a situation where you need to do a more complex thing. And then like a few hours into the game, it's like, now you have an airplane. And then a few hours later, now you have an airplane that can turn stealth and flip upside down. And like a few hours, you know, it just like adds and adds and adds. And for a single player game, that's a really great way. Like, you don't really feel like you're doing a tutorial in a lot of the modern, like Uncharted and Last of Us and Grand Theft Auto and like a lot of those kind of games. You don't feel like you're doing a tutorial, even though you sort of logically know at the very beginning of the game when you inevitably wake up groggy and you're like, oh, where am I? I don't have any of the cool abilities I used to have, right?
Well, or in the Uncharted series, like I think the last two Uncharted games, like 4 and 3, both start with a section where you're playing Nathan Drake as a kid, right? Right.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, I see what's going on here. Like, you don't want him to have all of his abilities yet and guns and stuff like that. You just want to tutorial the movement stuff. And so just take away all of the other options because he's still a child.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the second one did that by having you be in a sneaking around a museum where you're way overpowered, so you wouldn't be getting into combat, because if you got into combat, it could just say you lose, to try and just really make you be able to spend time walking around and sneaking first and then teach you combat.
You can have that part of like a nice story narrative as well when it's a single game, but I think in this scenario, you rather want to. You want to teach people as quickly as possible so that they can play with their friends, I think.
Yeah, and that's something I sort of was able to finally give in and be like, okay, we'll have a tutorial. Okay, it'll have a few okay dialogue boxes. When I started comparing it not to like the Uncharted ideal of like, okay, this is a 50-hour game or a 30-hour game that you slowly reveal the mechanics to, and compared it to something like League of Legends, where it's like you join the game and it's like a whole bunch of people just typing in all caps, you're horrible, please leave, you're worse than nothing, leave, I hate you, in all, because you're so bad at the game and no, you can't play with anyone and it's just, you know, toxicity. So compared to that, I think, you know, having at least some manual tutorial and then...
Although
we do have the concept in Spies of a beginner mode, so we turn off a few of the more advanced functions in that mode.
Speaking of online toxicity, we should probably talk a little bit about the next most common question after why don't you have an Android version, which is why no random online multiplayer.
Yeah, we I think it's really good to ship something because we've collected hundreds and hundreds of things that we knew we could polish and improve all the way down from little fonts that didn't quite align. Like we have two, we started changing one of the fonts from one font to a similar font, but there's a couple remaining places of the previous font and it kind of bothers me and it bothers our designer, Erica, that it's not fully done. Mm-hmm. But that's not what users are asking about. They're saying, why can't I play against random people on the internet? And it's a nice kind of focusing function. And there are, you know, other things that they're asking for. And they're all things that are in our list, but they're like the 10% of the list that is the they're asking after. And this thing of why can't I play against randoms on the internet was a fairly early decision that we made, and we would occasionally revisit it. But it, there's actually quite a few different reasons why we didn't. So the first one is kind of fairly fundamentally, the game was designed to be played with somebody in person, and that's when it's most fun. And at the minimum, played with a friend, because you're wanting to get to know that person and see what kind of tricks they use and how they play and what interests them and how you, like, oh, what they fall for, or you can set a reputation. You know, you can be really defensive for three games or and then jump and change strategies in the fourth one. And so the game is just more fun with a friend. And so we're like, well, we don't really want to go to do a bunch of work to support you playing against randos, and then people don't have fun just dying to a random person and then not really be able to learn from that, because then you get matched against a random person, like you're not learning against somebody. And so we were like, well, it's not that fun, so people shouldn't have it. But that doesn't make people not want it just because it's not fun. They don't know it's not fun because they haven't, like, it's almost like we should have a menu item. It's like, play against random people on the internet. And then it's like, hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may know me from previous videos, such as why you don't want this feature in this game.
Yeah, so you said that you've been revisiting it now and then. What triggers you to, like, when do you decide to revisit those type of things, like things that have been spoken about for a long time and then sort of decide to be put on like the not to do list? So like, is it mostly just like enough people ask for it and that's when you start looking into it?
Yeah, we had, I mean, Malin, you were one of our early playtesters, and we've had quite a few, been lucky to have quite a few developers and smart people on our playtesting list. And of course, they'll make suggestions like, why can't I play against random people? And the thing that I think most often would kind of come up as a reason to do it is, what do you do if you download the game and you don't have anyone else you can play against? You can't actually get a feel for the game playing against the little training bot, which is another one of those things that we weren't going to do. And then I just did it on one of our Steam Clock hack days. And it's like, ah, there's the little training bot. Okay, why not just merge it into the game? And now we've launched the game and a lot of people are like, pretty good game, but I eventually got bored of playing against the bot. Four stars. Like, they're using that training bot that I did as like a little demo to just help you learn the mechanics as like, that's the game to them, which is horrifying to me, because to me, the game is like we've had tournaments of people and like all of the strategy and stuff like that. But if you don't have someone else who has an iPhone that you see in person, it doesn't help you to be able to play in person against other people. Although you can do the pass and play mode, but this is not as satisfying. So, but it's quite daunting to say, hey, let's add this online multiplayer against randos. Cause it means you A, need to have a server that does that matchmaking. B, you need to have enough people online that you can get a game started pretty quickly. C, you have to try to deal with the issue of the people who play the most will be the best at the game and they'll tend to dominate. And so you will get often just, if you're new to the game, you'll get matched against somebody who will just destroy you. And it's not a very fascinating game to get destroyed at, because you can't ask the other person or like learn, you can't see their, it's like, it's sort of like losing poker online. Because you can't actually see the other people and suss them out and bluff, like, and there's that bluffing in the game. And then fourth, then we have to deal with all the griefing and like people trying to cheat and people trying sending hate mail and people trying to fuzz each other and send garbage over the wire. And like, there isn't any reason right now to behave poorly towards the server, because the server is only for you playing against a friend that you sent an invite link to. So the amount of, you know, we'd basically be asking for it. Not that, you know, if there was a clear economic incentive, then we could build a thing that was resistant to all those things and then figure out who's going to, how are we going to staff, like, dealing with incidents if something's happening at various times of day. But it's definitely a pretty big feature. Like, what do we say, what, 2 or 3 months was our guess of how much work it would be, Nigel?
Yeah, I think something like that. Because with that, we have kind of painted ourselves into a bit of a corner technically because of some of the origins of the game, that it is very built around like a model of gameplay that's pretty hard, particularly to fight against any cheating in any way, which would be a huge problem in random online games. Because there's too much information on the client, right? Like the classic... You know, the classic like networking blunder is leaving information that you don't want users to have on the client. And unfortunately, like we just kind of stumbled into that because the history of development of the game, like with originally being kind of a turn-based game center game, meant that it was like that rather than being like a normal, oh, here's the server and it's simulating things and you only get information you have. And like we could change it to be that model, but it would be a pretty terrifying amount of work to do that.
Yeah. No, I think if it would have been there in the first place, it would definitely be a different story because you could just decide to open it up more as a, I guess as a, like a rant, like you would have to open the lobby up. But I think if everything was already down server side, that would be a bit easier. But yeah, I understand from the history of the game, it's meant to be played when you're in the same room. So yeah, it makes sense.
But it's something I'm reevaluating more, though, as I see these people who are having fun with the game enough that they're like joining the Two Spies Reddit and they're making positive comments on the app review and they're sending emails and stuff like that. But they've only ever played against the bot.
Yeah.
And like, so I wonder if that really pains me.
So I wonder if it's many people who... Like this might go hand in hand with the and with there not being an Android app. I think all households might not have like only iOS devices or might only have the one iPad or something. So I think maybe it will be a bit if you would have an Android app, maybe it would be a little bit fewer requests on playing to random people online. But yeah, I don't know. It could. I think the bot also works quite well, but I see why it would get a bit boring after a while. But I mean, the bot can still be unpredictable at some points. Have you been thinking about making the bot more, I guess, a bit more strategic in order to make it more long lasting?
I mean, the toughest bot right now is the medium difficulty bot. So yeah, we do have some room to grow there, right?
Yeah.
That was a very specific check. Because like originally the bot was like purposely losing to you because... Oh, okay. The goal was for you to learn the mechanics, and then
I think in Spy School mode, the bot still does do some fairly intentionally stupid things.
Yes, like it'll purposely just if it can figure out where you are, it'll go beside you and then just like wait there for you to stumble into it.
I remember one thing that I was working on was to make the bot basically a bit dumber, I guess, in the tutorial, just because it felt like sometimes it was almost too aggressive for new people.
Yeah, it was dominating people.
Yeah, it just took over the whole map and took over the other people's cities. So I think we tried to make it a bit like less aggressive, I guess. But I think, I think it could maybe be like a bit more fun for people who can't find someone to play with directly. Maybe having like a more intelligent bot than the medium level could help.
Yeah, that's definitely on my 1.1 list. And like in an afternoon, I could easily make a harder bot without even having to make it cheat and like use secret information. there's like little stubs and to-dos in the bot that's like, in you know future, consider the fact that if they're like one thing the bot doesn't really consider right now is the consequences of you picking up extra, being able to pick up an extra action next turn and things like that, and like that it should either hide or go into deep cover and certain things. It does a little bit of that, but doesn't consider that very well. And we have all that information, so it is you know, and we know for example where you could be. You know, using those same could be here indicators. So the bot doesn't use your real location. It uses the same could be here indicators that you see. But yeah, definitely will make a harder bot. But giving people some better way to play against someone else is something that I'm back on being quite interested to fix. Like, you know, speaking of something that would require a whole bunch of code rewriting when we're talking about putting the game on the server. Also, putting the game on Android would be pretty huge.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like if we were to pick one, like, crazy huge thing, though, like, an Android port would be it, because it has a very clear benefit in terms of what we think the game is good at. Like, the thing that worries me about the, like, oh, should we have, like, you know, like, more play-by-email style of being able to take turns asynchronously, and should we have matching with randos, is I feel like we've got a pretty good idea that those aren't as fun as people think they're going to be. And so, like, yeah, we could add those, and it would definitely make some people's experience better if they're not in a situation right now where they can, you know, they have people around that they can play with. But, like, it's kind of adding worse modes to the game, I feel like. Whereas, like I said, what the game is the strongest at is, like, when you play it like a board game, when you play it in person. And I think that's kind of a, you know, sort of a fundamental flaw of the game. Like, I think if we'd realized right at the very beginning that was how it was going to be, it almost would have made less sense to pursue it, because that limits the market quite a bit, right? Of, you know, that you need two people that both have iOS devices and they're in the same room and want to play with each other, right? It's putting it more in that realm of you play at times that you could play a board game instead. And most people spend a lot more time playing games on their phones that are not like board games than they do playing board games with their friends, right? And so, it, you know, it's kind of a problem, but, like, ultimately that is what the game is good at. Like, that's the environment where it's fun, is where you're sitting, like, staring the other person down, trash talking in person, you know, getting tense about things. If you're just matched with some rando and there's no cost to exit if you're behind, or you're, you know, you're taking turns asynchronously, and by the time the next turns come, you've forgotten everything about what's going on and have to, like, refigure everything out. It's, you know, we've done experiments on playing both of those, and it's just not as fun that way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that trade-off of, all game design has a trade-off of, people will say they want to do things not having tried it, and the game designers will have tried the thing and they're like, yeah, it's not fun. Like, the infamous mm-hmm. one was Warcraft 3 had a problem with the economy not having enough gold sinks, and people just accumulate too much money and it became not fun because of that. And so they added this, like, tax, upkeep tax, that gold would get used to keep your enemies or your units going, and playtesters all hated it. And they all said, or in, like, World of Warcraft, the same thing, your equipment would get damaged and you had to, like, mm-hmm. repair your equipment, and everyone's like, oh, why is this horrible feature in here? Like, just take it out. And the game designers always had to be like, until we can come up with a less annoying way to take your money, which I need to do, because as a game designer, money's only valuable if it's limited and scarce, then we have to do this, sorry. And you kind of just have to infinitely ignore that same request to do the non-fun thing. But I think there's probably things we can do to allow fun games to get matched. Like, so one is that there's this Discord channel that, like, an unofficial Two Spies Discord channel that a player started just in the last couple of days. Oh, wow. That people are using to find people to play against.
That's great.
And then they, like, are not just playing against random matched people, but they're like, oh, actually, I'm, you know, I'm now going to be matched up with this person that I found who's, you know, cool girl 23, and she's playing spies, and, like, occasionally we play against each other, and then kind of learn what she does, and she learns what I do, and then you get some of that benefit of playing with a friend because you're playing with a consistent person. And so, kind of another thing sparking off of that that we've talked a little bit about, and this came from suggestion from some of the folks that were checking out the game really late in the play sequence, is it would be nice if you could more seamlessly invite someone who is a friend that you've already played to be able to play without having to, like, send them an invite code over iMessage or something, but do, like, a little push notification, like, oh, Alan wants to play spies with you right now, and then help you a little right now. Like, you have to keep the game foregrounded while you wait for the other person to join, but maybe facilitate a little bit better getting two people together into the lobby at the same time using push notifications or something. Seems like there's some things we could do to help you play against a quote-unquote friend To satisfy what people are asking for. What they're saying is, I want more interesting bots, and I want playing against randos, and I want play by mail. But what they're actually saying is, I want more ways to engage with the game than just playing this medium bot.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's really nice to hear that people sort of start to set up their like their own ways of connecting with each other. But I think, yeah, if you can have just like a list with the last people, like a list in the game, sort of showing the last people you played with, that could be really helpful for that.
Yeah, and it feels like we're going to get there. Like, you know, since we've been talking about that since the launch, like it feels like that's probably going to come in some form at some point. We just haven't worked out exactly how to do it yet, right? It's complicated. Like, you know, how much do we want to modify our server mechanism for that? Like, one of the nice things about the server right now is it's pretty close to stateless. Like, it's, you know, it's basically got a very simple model of matchmaking and a very simple model of coordinating, passing the turns back and forth between the players. And so introducing a matchmaking component is kind of a big complexity step up for the server, even though it's not actually that big a change on the client, right? Like, most of the bits and pieces we need on the client to do that are already there in one form or another, with like how the invites over iMessage work and stuff like that. But for the server, it's a pretty big jump in complexity. Or do we want to support something else? Like, do we want to bring Game Center back in after it having been like kicked out of the game, you know, 3.5-4 years ago, whatever it was?
We should probably say why that happened, because that's been a fairly common thing, is people say like, oh, why doesn't it have Game Center support? Mm-hmm. But when we initially implemented Game Center support in whatever version of iOS it was at the time, because it's a long running project, it was so buggy and so broken. And we tried quite a few like workarounds and stuff like that, but we just like had straightforwardly reproducible bugs, whereas like you invite somebody to a game and then when they tap on the invite on the other side, just like nothing would happen. Like, it wouldn't even join the game and things like that. And then they would restart their phone and then it would, which is like one of those obvious, like, it's got to be a bug if it didn't work. And then they restarted the phone and then it worked and things like that. And so one was, you couldn't invite iOS 12 phones from iOS 11 phones, or one of those directions or something like that. And it was just very buggy. And we would do searches and like, no one seemed, we filed radars and they didn't even get triaged. Like, they're still sitting as like,
yeah, I'm curious. I think sometimes when you're looking for documentation about different Apple frameworks, it can be quite limited on the amount of people actually using it out in the world.
Yes.
Did you feel like people were in general moving away from Game Center, or was it just not picked up?
And people weren't talking about it. I mean, game developers, and Nigel knows a bit about this, like, game developers don't always write as much about what they're finding and learning as people in like web development, for example, do. And so, and there's just like not that many, like for most games, if you do implement games, one person just implements it and then never touches it again. So it's not being implemented by millions and millions of different developers, but definitely did get the sense that it wasn't a lot of people.
And specifically in the case of Game Center, we had we moved away from it because of problems with the gameplay being implemented through it. Like, I actually went real-time follow-up. I went and looked at the change list history, and Alan's right that actually the multi-peer connectivity, which is still in there in the form of the like local wireless stuff, was first, though Game Center came in like 2 weeks after the first commit. So it was in there very early, but it was for the bulk of like the first year or so, year and a half maybe of development, it was like the main mechanism for passing turns. So it wasn't just, it was a matchmaking mechanism, but it wasn't just a matchmaking mechanism. It was also how we were passing the turns back and forth. And that made any problems with it significantly magnified, right? Because if there were Game Center problems, you basically couldn't play at all. I think actually there was a while there even where local wireless had been like deprecated and then in favor of just always doing it through Game Center, and then local wireless got brought back. But like when we were in that phase, we were like, okay, well, if this is going to be this twitchy, like it's completely impossible for us to implement the game against it. And so we bailed on it entirely. Whereas like probably if at that point we sort of thought about what we've, you know, what we've kind of figured out these last couple of weeks of like, oh yeah, you probably do need some kind of friend list and some way to invite people with push notifications. If we dialed back to it just being a matchmaking mechanism, like it might still have been flaky, but it wouldn't have been flaky in a way that like fundamentally compromised the game. Whereas when we were depending on Game Center for doing turns, it did kind of fundamentally compromise the game that it wasn't working.
We did end up in the circumstance that I kind of was a long fighting against, though, which is running a server. Like you say, it's a really simple server, but for a game in 2019, like it used to be that, yeah, you could sell games at a pretty reasonable per unit cost, and you know the original App Store had Super Monkey Ball on for $10, and unless I like $4.99 games still do get sold. But for the kind of game that we are, that's like a multiplayer game and you really want to be able to quickly invite your friend to play, it's got to be a free game with some sort of in-app purchase, which we could talk definitely about the business model stuff a little bit. But the, one of the things that's happened is that we have all these people out there. We've had 100,000 different matches or 100,000 rounds played out now across all the different people who've tried the app in the first week. And that's great. But we have the server, which is running that, and then we're maintaining that, and then we're making sure that it's not going down and things like that. And if it's something that we were to increase the complexity of and do more matchmaking and more services and stuff like that, I'd be almost inclined to say have some sort of seasons pass where it's like, oh, if you want to play matchmaking or if you want to have more sophisticated server functionality, then pay, you know, $2.99 for the year or something like that. So that if we eventually get to the point where it's like, oh, actually the user base isn't big enough to justify maintaining the server or keeping it running, then we can say, oh, okay, well, we're not going to charge you anymore for that $2.99 a year. Now, once the season passes roll off, then we can retire the server and people can still play the game, as opposed to this circumstance where you have like these, you know, not that old games that are, were fairly popular at one point where people are, you know, EA turns off the servers for, you know, some game that's like 6 years old because the player base numbers are low enough. Actually, honestly, they probably don't care as much about the player base numbers. They care more about new game sales, right? When new game sales peter off, then they're like, well, eh, we don't need this server anymore, right? And then for some games, you can't even play them at all.
Yeah, yeah. So you were talking a bit about the business model. Do you want to chat more about that? Or did you have any other things you have to cover first? Because I think this is something that's, I think like you say, there are still games selling on the App Store for like $4.99. But I think, yeah, especially since you do have that element that you need to pair up with something, I think that's was that one of the main arguments why you decided to go with the free version?
Yeah, that was basically the biggest argument, was this thing of the game is a multiplayer game that we know is most fun played against someone else that you know, which basically means that your ability to get someone else to play it with you is a huge determinant in you liking the game, mm-hmm. which means it should be very easy to play against them. And so that basically kind of drove us towards this free with in-app purchase. And I feel like there's got to have been at least three different times where it's like, all right, Nigel, I know we decided it was going to be free, but I'm going to try again to convince you. And each time he would be like, I don't know, what was the most recent one? Was it Game Center or no, Apple Arcade?
Yeah, Apple Arcade was one that we talked about.
Where Alan has a crisis and it's like, do we really want to be releasing a free game? Is that us? Is that Steam Clock? But basically every time we would go down the various paths and trade-offs, there wasn't any way where we could figure out for the size and scope of game and the type of game being a multiplayer game, but like a fairly simple looking board gamey game, we mm-hmm. just couldn't figure out any math, even just like napkin math, let alone like full on spreadsheet math, where the game had a reasonable amount of revenue from it, selling it at $4.99 or $2.99 or 99 cents or $9.99, any upfront cost in order to be able to play.
Did you look into having like a free tutorial or something where you only play against a bot and then have like
We talked about that a little bit. One of the things that killed that was that this idea that it's not very fun to play against the bot.
Yeah,
and so why would you want to pay more if you played it? And you're like, but I'm now reevaluating that a little bit now that people are having fun playing against the bot. Like we spend very little time. Less than 1% of the time that's been spent on the game was on the bot. So mm-hmm. if we were to spend an extra 1%, we could almost certainly make it more fun. And we never really play tested much. Is the bot fun to play against? It's very much utilitarian as using it as a training dummy is how it's been coded. So it may be that we could actually do that as like free to play against the bot and then pay it to play against other people. But then still, or like you could say pay one of the two people who's going to play has to have paid.
Yeah, that's a model that we did talk about quite a bit, was the idea of having the purchase be viral in some respect, like that as long as one player had paid for it, that other players would get it. Like we talked about having map unlocks like that for quite a while. We batted that idea around of like there's a couple of maps that are free and then there's, you know, a dozen different maps that you have to pay for, but if either player has paid for them, then you can play on them. And I think that would be viable, that kind of stuff of like locking up pieces of the game in weird ways. Also just kind of like rubs, I think, both of us the wrong way, right? Like if you go back to listen to some of the previous episodes of Up, Up, Down, Down, if this is your first one, there is a lot of us complaining about the state of in-app purchases on mobile games. And the model that we've settled on now of like, we're just selling cosmetics, right? It's the same, you know, it's the same deal as like skins in Overwatch or hats and Team Fortress and stuff like that. We're just like, hey, if you want things to look a little different and cooler, pay us some money, but the whole game is, you know, is available for either free or for the base purchase price. And all that you're paying for is stuff that doesn't affect the experience of gameplay in any way other than aesthetics. And that feels more honest, right? Even if it's not necessarily the way to get the most money. And we're kind of, you know, we're kind of lucky in that respect, I think, compared to a lot of game developers, is, you know, this is ultimately still a side project for us, right? We'd love if it was successful and if it became something that could be self-sustaining financially, but we knew going into it that there was a significant risk that wouldn't be the case. And we, you know, did it with money that we made doing other things. And so ultimately, if we don't find the business model that soaks the most money out of our players, like, it's not the end of the world the way that it would be if it was like, hey, we are two indie game developers and this is our big, you know, indie game release, and we've been like living on ramen for the last 3 years to make this game, and if it's not a hit, then we got to go back and get real jobs, right? Like, it doesn't have to be that much of a success for us to not, not suffer any hardship as a company, which is a nice situation to be in for sure.
Yeah, definitely the huge privilege of it being a side project means that we could make those kind of trade-offs. And it's definitely, we would occasionally go back to and struggle with it a little bit, but we made a pretty firm decision. It's like, if we're doing this as a side project because we want to have a fun side thing that, and to have worked on it and have people playing it, and it's super gratifying and awesome to see like thousands of people playing and having positive comments and people in the UK saying, hey mate, it's so fun, and all, you know, like the comments and stuff like that. Like, if we're doing it for that and to show off the kind of work that we can do, then we're going to make that decision to not include business models that make us feel bad and make the customers feel bad and generate, you know, 999 bags of gems subscriptions, just because that's economically on paper the thing that's short term.
I'm also not a fan of games where you sort of have to play in order to be able to pay in order to actually be able to play. I think there's some games where the game is like significantly harder unless you're paying something to get like a certain ability or something like that. So I think it's great that it's not that type of model at all. Are you still thinking about potentially making some extra maps or something like that? Or is it mostly?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the model that we have being like, no pay to win, still gives us lots of opportunities to charge for things. So our initial thing that we launched with is like the little pin on the map that represents you, your spy. You can buy and you can collect different pins, but it's really easy, like in terms of the amount of effort it would take to, you know, to add to the game, it's really easy for us to add some of the things. Like one of the things we talked about is maps a lot. It's like a fairly obvious thing. And somebody actually, one of the App Store reviews actually asked for like more maps, which somebody could easily charge for. Something that's even kind of nicer to charge for in terms of if you charge for it, or if one player gets it, then other people see that they've gotten it, which creates a bit of a virtuous cycle, would be taunts. So in the game, to prevent griefing and also kind of because it's funny, you get to pick from like a multiple choice taunt system of things that you can say if you're taunting the other person. I got that idea originally from Hearthstone does that. Instead of just letting someone type, they can say like, well met, or I will crush you, or whatever. So we have kind of similar things in the game. But there's a pretty small set that it comes with, but you could easily say like, oh, okay, for $1.99, you get the ability to say, I will crush you instead of something spy-like or whatever. And like, so, you know, allow the more expensive ones to slightly more violate the fiction of the world, which is one of those, you know, perks that a lot of games like this, like Dota and these kind of Overwatch and stuff, sometimes the more expensive ones are feel kind of more out of place, but then it's like, okay, well, if you're going to pay $10, you can be a cat, you know, otherwise you're going to be a spy.
Yeah.
And I think you could do that with taunts and other things. So it'd be pretty straightforward, I think, to add that. We just need to get to the point where we've gotten the player base. And this is a very different mentality for a free-to-play game than for a game that is just like a story-based game, where it's like step one, build a compelling enough game that a lot of people are enjoying it. And then step two, then increase the amount of money that any person who's playing wants to pay and feels good paying. And so we're still on step one right now. You know, we've had thousands of people, tens of thousands of people playing, which is great. But in order to make it really something that can, because you imagine like how many dollars does the average player spend on a phone game? It's like, pretty small number. And so in order to make it so that it's worth investing in more various ways and like more pins and maps and taunts and stuff like that, we need to probably be in the hundreds of thousands or the millions of players. And then once it gets to be that point, then it's, or if we have a fairly small player base, but it's quite dedicated, like if we see that, okay, there's tens of thousands of players, but they're playing a lot and they're playing over and over and over again, and there's a really active community, then sometimes you can also find a way to sell into that. And what kind of player base it develops also makes a difference into what kind of economy you want to build around that. Is it, you know, something that you could maybe charge more for, something like a season's pass for a whole bunch of stuff because you have a hardcore player, or no, I'm sure we wouldn't have a hardcore player base because it's a pretty chill game, but a more dedicated player base. Or if it's a lots and lots of people try it every once in a while and they're just kind of coming in and out, then a different model or different types of things to sell to them. So it's interesting, but it's also, I think, good practice for us, people who had, you know, all our previous apps that we had launched ourselves were all paid upfront apps, and all the apps that we launch for our clients are always like free apps that have some subscription or some other service, like, you know, like the Lyft app, for example, which we didn't work on, but that kind of thing where the app isn't actually the thing where the money comes from. It comes from some other service. So that's something that it's been kind of a good mental exercise to work through.
And that's one of the nice things about it as a side project, is it does give us a chance to like think about those things to a degree that we don't usually. Like, I definitely feel like having talked through all the business model stuff for Spies, like, gave me a lot of insight into how to think about that I didn't necessarily have before going through that exercise, because so many of our clients are not trying to monetize their apps specifically, right? And so, you know, it's a learning exercise. And that's one of the things that's always been valuable about Spies, like right from its origins as, hey, Alan wants to learn how to program Swift, is I feel like it's been very valuable for us in terms of like trying a bunch of new things and trying a bunch of different technologies. And, you know, some of those things do flow out into other apps that we work on, even if we're not games, right? Like, if we ever had to implement something with a real-time communication component, I'd be way more confident doing that now, having gone through the experience of us, you know, making the Spies server and having it do this very basic message passing and dealing with the issues of, you know, how do we synchronize things in various situations. And like, you know, before we went through that, I wouldn't have been confident of like, oh yeah, we could totally like write a real-time chat component. But now I'm a little more confident in that because we've been through part of that process once. And I think the, you know, the best side projects often have an element of that, of learning something new. And certainly, yeah, the business model stuff has been that for us on Spies. It made us think about something that we don't normally think about because of the kind of apps that we have done in the past, but you never know, right? It always could be that the next client that rolls in is someone who wants to try and monetize directly from the app. And then we've at least, you know, we've both got some basic answers to technical questions of like, hey, how do you implement that stuff? And we've got some answers to those higher level business model questions of how do you think about monetization in a way that is both respectful of the user, but also makes you some money.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been a horde of different like testbed things in the app, of things that we used first on Two Spies and then brought across to other apps that we worked on. Crash reporting and logging and analytics and the way that the server was set up and different parts of the server and deploying for the marketing website. And there's just so many little, you know, architectural things and process things around how pull requests work and how our board setup is. Like so many things we experimented first on Spies, and then it kind of teaches us, oh, that didn't work, let's not do that in other places, or that's great, let's use this everywhere else.
Yeah, you mentioned, I know that this was sort of meant for you to start learning Swift, and I think as soon as I picked up Swift, I wanted to continue working with Swift. Do you feel like this made Steam Clock in general pick up Swift? Was this sort of the project? Did you like quite quickly pick this up for client projects as well, or did it still take some time?
We did. I think it contributed. Obviously, we don't want to like railroad a client project into saying, hey, you have to use Swift. I mean, we would now, 5 years in, where like other projects are all Swift. And like we have some people who learned iOS development since Swift came out and barely even know Objective-C now. So definitely that's been a huge success for us. And this project helped us kind of bandwagon onto Swift really early, like before Swift 2, we were writing Swift. And then when Swift 2 came out, we started kind of doing that as our default. But obviously there's also been some downsides to us writing the game in Swift. I mean, it's pretty good language for game development in a vacuum, but it means that this Android port is a little bit more intimidating now that it's in Apple's programming language instead of in a cross-platform Unity or something like that.
The Swift story on Android is reasonably good for the kinds of things that you do in games. Like if you're porting a game, you know, if you've done it from the beginning of planned to do it on like iOS and Android, what would you have done differently? Well, you probably would have written most of the game in C++,
yeah,
which like working with Swift on Android is definitely going to be, if we do it, harder than working with C++, just because C++ is more established, but most of the conceptual problems are still there, right? You still have the like, okay, well, we've got this core that's being built with the native development kit that we need to figure out how to communicate and how to separate the UI and the core logic. And like, ultimately, I feel like if we had to do that, you know, it would, if we had already a correctly factored application that had all of the game logic nicely isolated and not dependent on the UI, there'd probably be like 50 to 60% of the app that you could just be like, yep, this just compiles against Foundation and like a couple of basic libraries like networking and stuff like that. And we can, you know, it can be a project of like a week or two to port that to Android. And then we have to, you know, then we have to write the UI on top of it. We don't have that code base factored that way already, which, you know, makes that a little more, you know, first we have to do this massive multi-month refactoring to get to that point, and then maybe we can port the core of it to Android. But
at which point you start to think like, oh, or should we just make Two Spies 2 and do it Two Spies 2 Hard, Two Spies 2 Furious,
yeah,
Revenge of the Spies? Should we do that in Unity and then it just, you click run, and then it mostly just runs on Android, iOS, Mac, Windows, whatever other platforms? You know, Two Spies for Xbox One X, you know, like they're all there, you know.
I think there's lots of advantages. Like, I mean, definitely if I would be in the camp, if we were considering that of trying to do it as porting the Swift core across, because I think that's a more interesting way to go. And like,
okay,
I mean, if we do it in Unity, then we all got to learn C# as well, which is like, a worse language than the ones that we already that we already know and like.
A, like, old deprecated version of C# that's like bundled into Unity.
I'd way rather be writing the app in Swift and Kotlin than writing it in C#, but yeah, I mean, I do think in general Swift is actually a pretty good language for game development. Like, it's a little bit of a shame that it's so specific to Apple platforms right now, because it has a lot of things that are the kind of things that, like, game developers want in a language. You know, it's kind of at the right level of abstraction of it does compile down to native code. It's got various outs that you can do things in a way more performance efficient way than you can in some other languages like Java and stuff like that. It's not a garbage collected language, which is actually pretty important for game development. Like, you do really want at least reproducible memory behavior. You know, obviously something like automatic reference counting that you've got in Swift is pretty close to garbage collection in terms of the end result, but the key thing from the point of view of developing a game in it is it's predictable, right? You don't have to worry about what's going to happen if a garbage collection pass happens in the middle of things. I do like Swift as a game development language. I would love to someday try and write a more gamey game in Swift. Like, I do feel like Spies is very much a game written by people who primarily make apps, right? It's very structured like an app, and, you know, thinks in terms of, like, the view controllers and the data model objects and stuff like that, as opposed to being more of a simulation like most games are, where you've got a world and you've got some entities in that world that are responding to various stimuli in various ways and moving around, and there's, you know, various systems that read those positions and things and render them out. Like, that's sort of the standard model of how a game is architected, and Spies is very different from that in a lot of ways. But I think Swift would also be a good language for writing a more gamey game in, because of all those, you know, all those factors of, like, performance and, you know, some automatic memory managing, but not all the way to garbage collection, and a lot of good abstractions for keeping logic under control, the way that, like, enums work in Swift, or the distinction between value types and reference types, are all things that are valuable abstractions for something that's as business logic heavy as a game is. You know, definitely better in that respect than C++, probably not quite as high performance as C++, and not as many libraries out there as C++, but there, you know, there's a reason that C++ has hung on so long in game development. Is it hits a very nice mix of having something that's high performance and where you can control the performance very carefully, but also has some reasonable tools to build abstractions out of. And, you know, most languages make such different trade-offs from C++ that they fall down for game development in one way or another. And Swift, I think, is actually pretty close to making the same trade-offs as C++ does, which means it would be a very good language to develop games seriously in. I just don't know if it'll ever happen. Like, I don't know if it'll break out of the Apple jail well enough for people to actually seriously considering implementing cross-platform games in it. But it'd be cool to try someday, for sure.
Yeah, that's the cool thing with Swift being open source. So yeah, maybe it happens someday. I haven't looked into that much, whether it's something that people start to pick up or not. I know that Swift is starting to be more picked up for server-side development. I don't know about in terms of games.
The cross-platform story is getting better and better all the time in Swift. There's a pretty reasonable Android port of it. There's a apparently quite high quality Windows port of it now that one of the, like, Swift community members, I think not even associated with Apple at all, has done. And so it's, you know, it's getting there, but something like that is such a long road, and so much of it's about perception, right? That if people think of it as being an Apple specific language, then people aren't even going to consider it. And there's certain you know, there's certain platforms that you would need a port to if you wanted to do serious game development in it, right? You'd need, like, you know, PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 5 and Xbox and Switch port of it, right? And that's a whole, you know, that's a whole other level of thing that people haven't even taken on. I don't realistically think that would ever happen, but I would really like it if it did, because I really enjoy working in Swift in the same way that I've always kind of enjoyed C++, but it has so many of C++'s rough edges sanded off in ways that I find really pleasant.
No, that would be really cool. In general, I like that Swift is evolving, and the more platforms it gets to, the more exciting, I think. So hopefully one day.
Yeah, maybe we'll end up finding ourselves writing that PlayStation 5 Swift port in some future parallel universe.
Yeah, you should pick up this project, I think. Now when Spice is done, this is the perfect opportunity to get into the open source development of Swift.
I feel like the we'll probably, you know, we'll iterate Spies as long as, you know, that's moving along well. And then we might take a little bit of a breather before we jump right back into a game. Or at least that's what I say now. We'll see what happens over the Christmas break if I don't end up cursing myself with a game prototype or something.
Uh-oh.
Definitely, if we do another game, we need to make sure it does not take this long next time. We need to commit more to it and try and get it done in a shorter time frame and with a little less like wandering in the woods searching for, hey, what even in technology are we going to be building this on, and what is the business model going to be, and all the things that took us so long to figure out on this game. Like, I would like to do another game for sure, but I wouldn't like to do another game the way that we did Spies. Like, definitely,
yeah, we learned
a lot.
You
know, that was the biggest problem with it is there was just so much iteration of things that we wasted time on. There was so much, I mean, not even just development time, like there was a fair bit of development time that we spent unnecessarily, but because it was a side project, it just took a lot of calendar time too. I mean, if we'd started working on it, you know, 5 years ago and just like gone at the same level of effort that we've been putting into it, like, you know, the last couple months we were trying to ship it, we probably could have got it done in a year or two, I think, without too much difficulty.
I think we could do it faster than that. Well, definitely now. Like, if the goal was take like me, you, Mullen, and Brendan and Jake, and it was like ship, you've lost all the code to Spies, but you have a running copy, create it again now, I bet we could like launch it in 3 or 4 months.
Maybe if we're just making Spies again, but I'm thinking like a new game, you know, something maybe related, but at least, you know, at least different, that we're have to solve some of those problems again, but at least hopefully, like I said, we wouldn't make the mistake of having it on the back burner so much of the time that it was just hard to get traction at various times in its development.
Yeah, and we've changed a lot of things about the way we do projects at Steam Clock and how we track things and how we plan things and how we set teams up and stuff like that. And in particular, how we work through product ideas, that in response to this One Spies project going so long, we've changed enough things that we've actually done multiple prototypes and projects that have started and either been validated and shipped, like quests, or validated as not being a good idea and like discontinued before it ever saw the light of day. Like, we've changed a lot of our product process since we started Spies to prevent a 5-year project, but the 5-year project still kept going along and it still kept being valuable because we'd done so much work on getting it to a point where it was fun that it made sense to ship this one. And then, you know, famous last words, but I think we've set ourselves up for the future stuff being a lot faster.
Yeah, I think I know the answer to this, but I think I saw some people on Twitter asking where the name Royal Pixel Service comes from, because the game is not sold under Steam Clock. It's if you look at the App Store, it's Royal Pixel Service.
Yeah, so there is a limit on how, I can't exactly fully describe the story of why the game is not being sold under our name and it's being called Royal Pixel Service, but I can say that our company name is Steam Clock Software, and we've made apps for years as Steam Clock Software, and after we had started on Spies, but not that recently. We went through the process of trademarking Steam Clock in the States as well as in Canada. And when we did that, we got a notification from a company who might be concerned about a trademark that has the word Steam in it, that wasn't particularly enthusiastic about the idea of us trademarking Steam Clock for software in general. They wanted it to not include games, which initially I was like, well, screw you. Like, I can have a game with published by a company with Steam in the name. That's not going to confuse anyone. But, you know, we're a 10, 15 person company. And, you know, sometimes there's a certain quantity of lawyers and things that you realize, you know what? I'm not going to pick that battle today. Let's have a new company brand for the games and side projects. So that's where Royal Pixel Service came in. And that's kind of a brand we have now that we can use for side projects, or we can use for experiments, or maybe it's a games thing we haven't fully fleshed out. It doesn't even have its own like logo or anything like that, but it's actually kind of nice sort of mentally to be able to have that option where we have like an actual separate corporate entity now, if we want, that we can kind of put things not under the Steam Clock banner, but as Royal Pixel Service. And we're interesting kind of like very obscure fun fact about Steam Clock, even though Steam, the Gastown Steam Clock is based in Gastown in downtown Vancouver, where our office is. The very original office for Steam Clock was, many years ago, was Nigel's basement in New Westminster, which is referred to as the Royal City. So there's a kind of a royal connection, obscure royal connection to the business.
Yeah. Was it called Steam Clock already back then?
Yeah, when we were in Nigel's basement, we were named after the landmark in the startup neighborhood miles away that we knew eventually we wanted to move to.
And I think we broke the pattern with our most recent office move, but I believe every office move prior to that one, we did get closer to the Steam Clock every single time. And now I think we're actually like technically maybe 50 or 100 meters farther away. Oh, definitely if you count elevation, because we're on like the fifth floor now and we're on the second floor before. But I think even in terms of
it tells
like,
you we're pretty close if the elevation makes a difference.
I think even in terms of like walking distance on the ground, we are slightly farther away than we were before. But, you know, now we're only a couple hundred meters from the Steam Clock either way. So
hacking away.
Yeah. Still close enough, I think.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks everybody for listening. If you want to hear more regular podcast episodes with yours truly, you can check out the podcast Fun Fact. You can catch Mullen on the shows Cup of Tech and We Like Games. And if you want to learn more about Two Spies, you can go to playspies.com. You can find Two Spies on the App Store, or you can find on Twitter @PlaySpies.